You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, this is Dennis Dunaway of Alice Cooper. You're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
History in five songs. With host Martin Popoff. A production of Pantheon Podcasts. Let's rock out with Martin.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back again to another episode of History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff, brought to you by the good folks at Pantheon. Happy as always to be part of the network, the Pantheon Podcast Network. These podcasts, their whole array of podcasts, they're all music podcasts, are available on Spotify, iTunes, and over 40 other podcast platforms. Now, this episode, we are going to celebrate the life of Neil Peart, passed on from glioblastoma, a form of brain cancer, January 7th this year. Shocked a lot of people, shocked everybody, because they kept this very, very secret. But yes, I want this to be a celebration. I can't but help but Neil, when he heard the diagnosis, thinking, this is perfect. This is exactly like one of my songs, and having just a wry, ironic laugh about the whole thing. I mean, I don't know why I think that. I just, it's part of his personality to see the humor in everything. And I just thought, he thought, this is like my songs. This is what I've been writing about, all my life, loss. You think of Vapor Trails. We're going to celebrate Vapor Trails later on as well. But yes, we are calling this episode Neil Peart, 12-Panel Man. Why are we calling it this? Back in my university days in Hamilton, I was in the second year of MBA. A buddy of mine, Craig Elliott, lived right next door in the apartment complex. He was in engineering. We were into alternative comics. And we used to say, about somebody who's lived a very, very full life, one thing we used to do is we used to call them Satan, saying, only Satan could have lived this many lifetimes. But the other thing, looking at comics and even drawing a few comics we would do, 12 panels meant 12 different life experiences, like a lot of living packed into this. Gee, he's a 12-panel man. Anybody we looked at and said, he's lived a really, really full life. I think the ultimate 12-panel man has got to be Alice Cooper. Somebody should write a book just on that at some point. I've written an Alice Cooper book. It was 140,000 words. It was a massive book because this guy probably lived 24 panels. That's an interesting thing about Alice, is that he's done so much. You got to think, how can this guy have squeezed in so much life? That's what I want to say about Neil Peart. I think to celebrate how much living he did, how much of a Renaissance man he was, and how much, frankly, he pushed Getty and Alex to be the Renaissance man they became. I think of it literally being that first spark, that dual spark, back in the very first rehearsal, seeing how great a drummer he was, thinking they had to raise their game, and also quickly finding out that this guy reads books. He could write the lyrics. And, thinking, these guys, Alex and Getty at this point, are not particularly intellectually curious, but they became intellectually curious throughout their lives very quickly because of the example of Neil Peart, who of course went on to be Rush's lyricist, which is one of the great things about him. Forget about the drumming. I mean, the lyricist aspect is pretty amazing as well. So yes, History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff, 12-panel man, Neil Peart. You know, it was interesting seeing, I'm recording this the day after the announcement. It's interesting to watch the Facebook outpouring. You know, I also went and I wanted to see how the press was treating it. You know, I was quite sort of offended that that CNN and Fox News and the like, you know, were I mean, the news was there, but it wasn't you know, particularly prominent. They had other older stories of I would think lesser figures and deaths that are still lingering around. You know, hard to explain, but I just didn't think it was covered that fully. It could have been covered a little more fully. Here in Canada, of course, I'm in Toronto, it was covered much more fully. You know, Rush. Their Order of Canada recipients, Neil, Getty, Alex, Brian Adams, Celine Dion are probably our biggest, you know, rock music figures. But, you know, we also lost another one to brain cancer. It was a huge deal up here. Gord Downie from the Tragically Hip. You know, that was a death lived out a completely different way from Neil's. I mean, Neil, he's a secretive guy. He was always a quiet guy. One of the narratives behind him, of course, was that it was always Alex and Getty who were doing the meet and greets, and Neil didn't like doing that kind of thing. Gord Downie went on a cross Canada tour with brain cancer. And they did a prodigious amount of songs, different set lists every night across Canada and back. It was an amazing, you know, show of strength the way he treated the whole thing. And you know, Justin Trudeau, our premier, was at the show, the last show, maybe even more than one show. Anyways, he was part of the thing. There was a big movie and a documentary. It was a pretty big deal. But yeah, this caught everybody by surprise. I don't want to go too into it, but it's crazy. I mean, I've done 3 Rush books, and I have actually finished months ago 3 more Rush books covering all the decades. Big, definitive, lots of words, Rush books. The first one is slated to be out in a month or two. It's called Anthem Rush in the 70s. Then there's going to be Limelight Rush in the 80s. And then there's going to be, what did I call it? I can't even remember what I called it. Anyways, it was about the 90s until the end, obviously, which will need some rewriting at this point. But you know, the timing, it's crazy. I mean, we were sending out advanced reading copies, they're called, to prominent people, rock stars, and basically saying, hey, do you want to do some flap text on this? And you know, Mike Portnoy, you know, respectfully declined. Mike is a great guy. I mean, he was part of my old Rush book, album by album. He's always very responsive. You know, he's always considered the next, the next big drummer after Neil. You know, if Neil was the great one, as they say in hockey parlance, Mike Portnoy was the next one. But he, you know, and now I know why. I mean, obviously he was pretty close. He was pretty close with the family. And, you know, there was a really nice response from him, a picture of him with his son and stuff on Facebook. But yeah, it's crazy. So Rush has been on my mind, having just done this massive amount of writing these 3 more Rush books, this trilogy thing. But enough about that. Let's continue with this celebration, and let's talk about some music. And what, like I always do in here, these songs are picked to represent something. There's, you know, I wanted to say something a little bit different about Neil. You know, this might get a little contentious. I've brought this up at Rush Cons before, and this first one's gonna illustrate the point somewhat, although not exactly. Yeah, I'll explain after we play it. Take a listen to this. This is the beginning of Temples of Syrinx. All right, so why did I pick that one? I mean, I thought long and hard, what am I going to pick for the first song? I was going to pick Anthem to show Neil exploding into this band on the Fly By Night album, with his great drumming. You know, mention Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand, proving that Neil was reading books early on, and Ayn Rand is like this guru of self-efficiency and selfishness, somewhat, which got Neil into trouble when he would have to do interviews and he would get fed up having to talk about this all the time. So Neil explodes into view on that album. There's Caress of Steel after that. But I wanted to pick Temples of Syrinx and the beginning of Temples of Syrinx for one key reason. You all heard it there. It's this idea of this drummer with this drum set with these perfectly tuned lots of toms from small to large, doing these great fills like this, and the grooviness of the second fill in here, and that great drum sound that Neil got out of Terry Brown. Now this illustrates a point I've always felt about Neil. I think Neil is the Beatles of drummers. How everybody talks about, the Beatles were the geniuses of hooks. Those songs will live on forever because they're so hooky. You know, many bands get compared to the Beatles later on, but there's only one Beatles. You know, Neil, the thing about Neil, which is incredible that everybody loves, I saw Scott Ian's post saying, I'm going to go away and air drum a bunch of Neil Peart. It's the aspect that everybody, drummer or not, wants to air drum to Neil. And the reason is because he creates drum hooks. You know, you think back to the likes of Keith Moon and Ginger Baker and these big predecessors before Neil. I saw a great post by one of my Facebook friends saying, you know, the Mount Rushmore of drumming is Ginger, Keith Moon, John Bonham, and Neil Peart. It's complete now, he says. I thought that was a kind of a neat thing. But, you know, Neil is the king out of all four of those, frankly, of this idea of creating hooks. So he is literally, he's the pop drummer in a way. He creates fills that are pop, that are hooky, and you remember them and you want to air drum them. So, and you know, you listen to something like this, this is the kind of thing that inspires drummers to go get drums. I was inspired by Neil. I went out and bought a 9-piece Pearl, you know, black, you know, open on the bottoms of the toms, small toms. I believe I had even the rototoms at one point. Maybe not. Maybe I just had the small toms, but I was inspired by Neil. I was also frankly inspired by Peter Criss, same sort of thing. And Peter was sponsored by Pearl at the time. But you know, Neil inspired drummers of my generation, you know, the mid to late 70s, probably more than any other drummer, John Bonham as well. Yes. But Neil was the kind of guy who basically came up with these things that just completely mesmerized you, these great fills. And also what I wanted to mention here is, so here's the little bit of a negative thing about this, and it turns into a positive. So there's the idea that a little bit different than this, use for example with me the song Fly By Night or the song Closer to the Heart. These are up-tempo pop songs. What does Neil do? He does busy little things. He does little unison things with Getty for fills. He hits funny little cymbals and stuff. There's the toms. Now, you know, Rush gets criticized for this quote-unquote overplaying thing, along with Getty's, you know, pretty obscure eccentric voice. But, you know, If you're a classy person, if you're a classy musician, you're supposed to only feed the song and only do what the song requires. And if it's a pop song, it means check your ego at the door and pull yourself out of the situation and just live for the song. Just do what the song requires. Well, Rush turned that on its head, and you hear it more so in something that would be a poppy song. It's more flagrant in this way rather than a big prog metal, heavy metal feast. And so my point is that if you're the only one brave enough to do that, like Neil did, and you stick your head out there and you stick your head out there for criticism, not many people are going to do this, and you are going to stand out. So Neil stood out because he did this. Basically, it's considered a bad idea or bad taste. But if you're the only one doing it, you are brilliant because you are completely remembered, and there's a certain portion of the rock fan audience that is going to flock to that. And again, at the end of all those bars, even if it's a pop song, drummer or non-drummer, you raise your hands and you do those fills. Okay, moving on. I'm trying to watch the time here. I don't want this to go too long or too over. It's funny, when I do these History in 5 songs, they always come within a certain time frame. Maybe it's because I feel like I'm going to pass out at some point. But let's move on. So let's move on to the second track. This is Tom Sawyer. Take a listen. All right, so I had to pick this one. There's no way I could not pick what you just heard in a celebration of Neil Peart's remarkable life and remarkable drumming career than the ultimate Rush fill of all time. This is the fill that everybody thinks about, super Rush fan or not, as the most famous Rush fill ever. I love this. Obviously, it's incredible. The cool thing about this fill, another interesting thing about Neil, and I don't want this to sound negative too, but it might sound a little negative, but I'll just say it. So Neil's, if you were an up and coming teenage drummer, like I was, like a lot of guys, you could actually work out these parts and probably play most of them. I could play this part, but it would be a little messy. And this is kind of an interesting thing about Neil too. I'll get to it. I hope I don't forget it, but I want to finish this point. So the neat thing about Neil, he had the single bass drum. So you always were able to discern what he was doing. It wasn't completely inscrutable like jazz drumming or Steely Dan records or Mahavishnu Orchestra records, Billy Cobham, whatever. It always felt like it was within your wheelhouse to play these things. And indeed, I and all kinds of buddies of mine were able to play these things. So that was kind of really interesting. And again, that kind of goes to the poppiness as well, the pop and the hookiness of this. They sounded great when you played them, and they were just within the realm of what you can do. Now, to get back to the previous point, one fascinating thing about Neil and Tom Sawyer is he always said this. He said, it's a hard song to play. He would come out and say, it's a hard song to play. And what he meant by that is it's a hard song to play with complete fluidity and to play it right every night. I mean, it has other things that are hard about it in terms of even just the speed of the hi-hat, how fast you have to play that hi-hat. But again, it's how fast you have to play that hi-hat and to play it, very uniformly throughout whatever this is, 4 minutes, 5 minutes long. But these fills are just joyous. You listen to that. It's incredible. He's using a beautiful array of cymbals, a beautiful array of toms, really cool, floor drum, bass drum combinations. There's a lot of cool snare drum in there. This is the quintessential Canadian song too. It's recorded at Le Studio, up there in the snow, in the winter, in the spring, rural environment outside of Montreal. It's a key Canadian thing from a Canadian icon. It's Rush's most famous song off their biggest selling album, Moving Pictures. Let's take a break now. We will power through this when we get back. But yeah, let's take a break and hear from our sponsors.
When we dropped the first few episodes of Rock and Roll Archaeology into the feed 3.5 years ago, little did we know that this telling of rock and roll history would become a pantheon of rock and roll podcasts. Since many of you first joined us on our rock and roll exploration, the halls of the rock and roll pantheon have filled with shows like Deeper Digs in Rock, Rock and Roll Librarian, Muses, Art of Rock with Caution Friends, Real Rock with the Reverend Andy King, Miss Pamela's Pajama Party, Vinyl Snob, and more. We are proud of this one-of-a-kind approach to an audio magazine of high-quality shows. That is Pantheon, and thank you for your support. We couldn't have done it without you, our diggers who listen to all of our shows. And now, we are excited to let you know that every show available as part of Pantheon can be found in their own podcast feed to subscribe to in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review the shows you've come to love. We look forward to adding more shows to fill the halls here in our Pantheon of Rock and Roll, and find them all at pantheonpodcast.com. Keep up the rockin'.
All right, so we are back on History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff. This is the episode we're calling Neil Peart, 12 Panel Man, because this is a man who has definitely, on the bright side of this horrible tragedy, this is a man who lived a very, very full life. So we can take some solace in that. So our third song, let's take a listen and we shall discuss. This is After Image. All right, I wanted to pick this song for a number of reasons. This is Neil speaking, as a lyricist, very eloquently and empathetically and passionately about the passing of Robbie Whelan. He was an assistant engineer up there at Le Studio, moving pictures, signals. Great song, great album, Grace Under Pressure. They found it to be a very difficult album to record. But the other reason I love this, I wanted to play this for you guys, is to represent the idea of the inquisitive, fearless musical pioneer. After this, they went on to Power Windows and Hold Your Fire. Records I don't particularly like, Presto, Roll the Bones, those four in a row, I'm still never going to be crazy about, I don't think. But what I do love is the spirit of exploration. This is where they're starting to adopt reggae beats, and Neil, God love him, he's just a massive Stuart Copeland fan. I talked to Stuart about this once, and he says, and this was not that long ago, so I'm sure Stuart was in on the know as well on this horrible secret. But Stuart says, oh God, every time we'd get together, the Rush guys would be, typical Canadian, apologizing for biting on the police and being so inspired by the police and doing so many policey type things across some of those albums. I would say starting with Signals and certainly on Grace Under Pressure, you think of Distant Early Warning as well. Neil became this the main thing you would take from the Police is the intricate hi-hat work, so he'd start doing that. But you hear on here as well, he's starting to mix the electronic drums with the acoustic drums. One funny thing I always talk about, and I thought would have been pretty interesting, and maybe somebody could still do it one day, I certainly would have rather Rush go super heavy, like we had an early episode on the new wave of British heavy metal, the bands from the 70s who took inspiration from the new wave of British heavy metal and went even heavier. Imagine how cool it would have been had Rush, after Moving Pictures, made a record twice as heavy as Moving Pictures, and you'd see them in leather jackets and stuff like this. And I don't know, I just sometimes dream that what if Rush would have gone that direction rather than this direction. But the cool thing about these guys is they are always exploring, always looking, and Neil was driving this process as much as anybody else. Getty with his keyboards, of course, but Neil was into triggering and sampling, and he got into African rhythms. So you hear across the likes of certainly Hold Your Fire album, you hear some sort of African rhythms applied to what he's doing, but very electronic and very rigid and very snappy snare drum with the Peter Collins production. That was one of the reasons Peter Collins was on board. I mean, they just loved that this guy represented a poppy British The Fix sort of Tears for Fears aesthetic of loading up on production. Now, obviously, like I say, I'm not crazy about those albums, but that's the problem with being first adopters. is it first adopters or first, you know how it works in computers. I mean, the first people in have to go through a lot of the teething pains of this stuff. I mean, Getty was in there very early on with synthesizer technology, but at this point, you know, some of these things sound dated because of being first adopters. Wow, look at the time. We better move on. I don't want these things to get too long. So let's move on and listen to our fourth track. This is Vapor Trail. All right, so yeah, so the horrible thing about this record, I love Vapor Trails as an album, but the horrible thing is Neil obviously had to endure the tragedy of his daughter Selena at 19 years old, driving back from university, dying in a car accident on the 401, you know, a highway that if you're from Toronto here, we've driven many, many times. I'm sure Rush up and down there many, many times. Horrible, horrible thing. And then Jackie, his common-law wife, dying shortly thereafter of cancer, and the heartbreaking thing, as Neil would say, she died of a broken heart. So this album is about those tragedies. And, you know, to have now also with Carrie and Olivia, you know, you also have again a small family, and now they are without a dad and a husband. So the horrible thing about this record is it is about loss. I love the drumming on this record. I love the compactness and just the joie de vivre of this album. But I wanted to play this because this is my favorite moment from Vapor Trails, and I would say it's probably because of Alex more than anything, that big mournful guitar dive that comes in there. But you hear Neil, you know, driving this thing with a lot of passion. But yeah, I wanted to pick this one as well to represent lyrically. I just wanted to mention one other lyrical thing. I noticed a lot on Facebook that a lot of people were quoting from Losing It, from Signals, almost, you know, possibly my favorite Rush song of all time. I love Circumstances as well. But Losing It is particularly poignant, as people are mentioning. You know, it is a beautifully written song about, well, I'm going to read you the first stanza here. The dancer slows her frantic pace in pain and desperation, her aching limbs and downcast face, aglow with perspiration, stiff as wire, her lungs on fire with just the briefest pause, the flooding through her memory, the echoes of old applause. So, you know, this song does not really apply to Neil's situation, as we've learned. I mean, basically, they retired about 3.5-4 years ago or whatever. We've now heard that, you know, Neil knew about this brain cancer diagnosis about 3.5 years ago. So Rush is retiring, and it corresponds with Neil's diagnosis. Do with that what you will. But, you know, the interesting thing about Losing It that I really like is and why people are, you know, mentioning it here. So it is about... it is about a dancer losing her skills, and it is about a writer losing his writerly skills. So Neil is a dancer on the drums, and he is also a writer. That's the other thing about Neil as the 12-panel man. He went out and wrote a ton of books, you know, essentially travelogues first and then reflections on music, essentially, and reflections on touring. I always thought this was one of the hilarious things about Neil, too. You know, here's a guy who doesn't like to do interviews, famous for not being the spokesman. I mean, he did a lot of interviews early on, but famous for not being the spokesman, famous for not getting out there meeting people. So what does he do? Typical Neil, he finds a novel solution and a working man solution to the whole thing. He says, I'm going to say everything I need to say over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, put it out there, multiple copies, people can buy it if they want. they've heard the ultimate Neil Peart interview just by getting all my books. So essentially, he one-upped his bandmates who are out there doing all these interviews and doing lots of press over the years by just kind of leapfrogging them, almost the way he could leapfrog the tour bus and get on his motorcycle and drive to the next tour stop. Almost the same sort of metaphor or corollary. So here he is being the ultimate interviewee and doing it his way by doing all these books. So Losing It is kind of interesting in that it's about a dancer. Neil's a dancer on the drums. It's about a writer. But I like how the end of it, some are born to move the world, to live their fantasies, but most of us just dream about the things we'd like to be. Sadder still to watch it die than never to have known it. For you, the blind who once could see, the bell tolls for thee. So the end is very poignant about Neil, because the 12 panel man, again, he lived this full life of travel, of bicycling, of motorcycling, of reading, of being a huge rock star. Pretty much, put it this way, I've always had this discussion about Rush, but they were living the full-on rock star life just with not a lot of money, starting pretty much in 1976. It ramps up a little bit. They still really are not that rich, around moving pictures. But after that, you know, they basically are in hockey arenas for the rest of their lives. They're huge. They're a huge band and huge rock stars. So they got to live that life. He got to live two families. And again, just so much being a Renaissance man and being into so many different things. And again, what I love about it and the gift he gave probably to Alex and Getty the most is the example of being a Renaissance man and a learned person. And those guys came along and did pretty much exactly the same thing and have lived lives as full as Neil. Okay, moving on, our last track here. This is a little bit of Clockwork Angels, the title track from Clockwork Angels, Rush's last album. Take a listen. All right, I wanted to pick this because I wanted to show Neil coming full circle with Nick R. Bouge, you know, driving Neil along, conducting with the drumsticks, giving Rush a big analog sound. This is Neil back in you know the expression and the spontaneity of Keith Moon. This record was recorded more spontaneous than usual, more analog than usual. It's got a great, huge, warm, rich drum sound. And I just wanted to tie it up and show Neil back in those days, you know, the Hush days, the J.R. Flood days, the woodshedding at home days, the going to London and trying to be a big rock star and loving Cream and The Who and, you know, the prog stuff, and just him having that magic that all drummers feel at the very beginning. And I feel he got there at the very end again with this record. There's just a lot of joyous, groovy drumming. You know, Neil, you know, people talk about Neil, and you know, there is definitely that period when things were locked to a grid and they were not very groovy, but there's a lot of groovy stuff that Neil did. And I just thinking back to these tracks and playing them, I mean, very, very groovy stuff on the likes of 2112 and even Moving Pictures. But I love that. I think this is one of the grooviest drumming situations that Neil was ever in, and it's really cool that it was the last album and it came full circle. So there you go. I just wanted to close up with that, and I wanted to read, Rush's official comment on this. It is with broken hearts and the deepest sadness that we must share the terrible news that on Tuesday, our friend, soul brother, and bandmate of over 45 years, Neil, has lost his incredibly brave 3.5-year battle with brain cancer, glioblastoma. We ask that friends, fans, and media alike understandably respect the family's need for privacy and peace at this extremely painful and difficult time. Those wishing to express their condolences can choose a cancer research group or charity of their choice and make a donation in Neil's name. Neil Peart, September 12th, 1952 to January 7th, 2020.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.